Hello and welcome back to the Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Alan Chartok. Joining us today to discuss gynecology, including new guidelines for cervical cancer screening and laparoscopic and robotic surgeries, are Drs. Amy Novat and Rachel Mash. A member of the Mid-Hudson Medical Group practicing in Rhinebeck and Kingston, Dr. Amy Novat is a graduate of New York Medical College in Manhattan, formerly the chief resident at Reading Hospital and Medical Center in, that's Reading, Pennsylvania. No, I'm so sorry. Novat received certification from the American Board of Obstetrics and Gynecology in 2009. Also joining us today, and we're lucky to have both of them, is Dr. Rachel Mash, Associate Director of the Division of Family Planning at Beth Israel Medical Center in Manhattan, a graduate of Brown University School of Medicine in Providence, Rhode Island, and having earned her Master's of Public Health degree from Columbia University in 1999. Mash is also certified by the American Board of Obstetrics and Gynecology. Her main areas of interest are family planning, contraception, education, and cervical cancer screening and prevention. Dr. Novat, Dr. Mash, welcome to the Vox Pop.
Thank you, Alan.
The number to call is 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. You can also post comments at the bottom of today's show page on the Vox Pop section of our website, wamc.org/VoxPop. You can comment below today's Vox Pop wall post on our Facebook page, facebook.com/WAMC Radio. You can also tweet your questions and comments at, remember that at sign, WAMC Vox Pop. And most importantly, and the one that most of us understand the best, you can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. So, doctors, I'm so happy that you're here with us. It took us a long time to get you here, but you're finally here. It's great. Thanks to the intervention of our wonderful board member, Joe Brody, and his wonderful wife, Sue. A big shout out to both of them, who I know are listening right now. So I want to ask you a question, and the phones are beginning to light up now. 1-800-348-2551. So what's hot in gynecology? Rachel?
So I think one of relatively new thing is pap smear screening guidelines that have changed substantially over the course of certainly since I have been doing medicine. When I was a resident and for many years, we encouraged women to get annual gynecology exams, which included an annual pap smear.
And what is a pap smear again?
It's a screening test for cervical cancer.
Okay.
So we would do those every year on women as early as 14, 15, 16 years old, and we would do them annually for the rest of their lives. Mm-hmm. That has changed substantially. And the latest recommendations now are not to start screening until age 21, and then from 21 to 30 to have a pap smear every 3 years, and if it's negative, to continue that every 3 years until age 30, at which time we add to the pap smear a human papilloma virus test, an HPV test. And if that pap and HPV test, if both of those are negative, then the recommendation is, if you're over 30, have had 3 consecutive negative pap smears in the last 10 years, and have a negative pap and HPV test, that every 5 years is your new screening schedule for pap smears.
Now, HPV as a human papillomavirus is a fairly, as I understand it, widespread thing for anybody who is a disease, for anybody who is sexually active. Is that right?
That's correct. 50% of people exposed who are sexually active but exposed.
Wow. And we know it leads to what? It could possibly lead to cervical cancer?
There are 2 subsets of HPV, what's considered low-risk HPV and high-risk HPV. And there's a whole array of numbers associated with those different strains of HPV. But we screen this HPV test that Rachel speaks about is for high-risk HPV. And the high-risk HPV is what leads to cervical cancer, where the low-risk HPV subtypes are associated with warty lesions.
And which is more likely to be the case? In other words, what are women more likely to have on an epidemiological basis? You know, the more dangerous one or the wart one?
Well, up to 80% of a given population can be exposed to the high-risk HPV populations. But of that of those 80%, many of these viruses clear within 6 to 12 months.
So really?
So they may have exposure, but then they get cleared. And so that's why, based on the pathophysiology of HPV and the long, long time it takes from the time of exposure to persistence to bad cancer, takes decades.
So if you're going to be evaluated for this, put it another way, it's important to be evaluated for this, right?
It's imperative.
Yeah. Now there's now a vaccine for HPV, right? And we'll be getting to the calls. We have one more call, and we have five people on the phone, which is great. So there's a vaccine. We know that young women can take it. Could you get that vaccine after you've been exposed to the HPV?
You can get that vaccine after. However, if you have already been exposed to a certain high-risk type of HPV, the vaccine, which covers HPV 16 and 18, which are two of the high-risk HPV types that are responsible for 70% of cervical cancer.
Wow.
So if you've already been exposed to HPV 16 or 18, then the vaccine won't be helpful to you because you've already been exposed. You can't unexpose yourself.
Okay. So what if you find, and one more call, and we're going to take all these calls, but what if you find a woman has HPV? What's the next step if it's a high risk? Amy?
Well, they're followed by pap smears, and the presence of HPV just certainly alerts the gynecologist to informing that patient, of course, that she's been exposed, focusing on how important having her pap smears are, and then instructing her and teaching her what it means with regards to her sexual activity.
Which means she doesn't pass it on to somebody else.
Well, the things that she should think about vis-a-vis new partners or her current partner. What's often happening, particularly in the middle-aged woman, is she might be just first tested for HPV now after years of having annual pap smears and being told that she's been exposed to HPV. And the first question, of course, is where did I get this? When did I get this? And the hardest answer is the truth, which is we don't know, that a person may have been exposed to the HPV virus even decades ago, first partner, or perhaps more recently. And so that's been a clinical challenge.
So what do you do to avoid cervical cancer if you're a high-risk HPV?
Well, we've shown that having pap smears and now doing the assay for
No, I'm sorry, Amy. I'm not being clear. It's my fault.
Mm-hmm.
But what do you do once you have ascertained that the patient has the high-risk HPV and you know that this can lead to cervical cancer, 70%, you say, of cervical cancer is this way. What do you do to prevent the patient from getting cervical cancer?
The only prevention that we have is to continue screening. There are ways in which we treat women who have had abnormal pap smears associated with HPV, and there's an array of treatments out there. And these treatments are not only therapeutic in that they remove abnormal tissue with the HPV virus, but also helps us determine if there's any abnormal cells deeper in the tissue of the cervical stroma. So, but
unlike other cancers, you can't remove the cervix, right? I mean, that's not a preventive. I'm very ignorant here, but that is not something you can do, right, Rachel?
Well, you can remove the cervix, but we don't need to do that. The thing about HPV is that there is a really long precancerous stage. So from the time
dysplasia, is that what
exactly? So and different stages of dysplasia. So if we catch it in the 10 to 15 years, that if it does persist and go on march on to being cervical cancer, if we catch it in that 10 to 15 year period, we can remove abnormal cells without removing the entire cervix.
How do you do it? What do you use?
There are several different ways. One is a LEAP, which is an acronym that stands for Loop Electro-Excision Procedure, which is an outpatient in-the-office procedure done with local numbing medicine. Another is cryotherapy, which is freezing the cervix, and that can get rid of the dysplastic cells, that can freeze the dysplastic cells. So there are really relatively easy, relatively non-invasive procedures that can be done during this precancerous stage that can prevent cervical cancer and invasion.
Okay, look, thank you for that, for both of you, and I apologize for what I don't know. Let's go to Tim in Gilderland. Tim, you're on.
Thanks, Alan. I'm going to start the show off with probably the silliest question, but give it a shot. There was a Senate candidate out in Kansas last fall who claimed that he talked to an obstetrician and was told that a woman who had been raped or had non-consensual intercourse could prevent pregnancy simply through a force of will.
Yeah, we remember that one. What an idiot.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, well, I wanted the doctors to comment on that.
Okay.
I don't know that I could say all the words that I want to say about this matter here on public radio. It is astounding to me that we live in 2013 and that there are such zealots out there who discredit all that we know around science and the human body and would make such unbelievable comments. And it is, for me, just another expression of the patronizing misogyny that exists out there. A lot of people out there still are not interested in seeing women have access to health care and to have equal rights and the respect that they should have.
Rachel, very quickly, because we have to go to a break. Go ahead.
Well, I think I can just say ditto to that. I mean, I think that the claim is so astronomically ridiculous because we certainly have seen, you know, there's, I don't even think I can justify that. When that came out, it was just so shocking to all of us in the medical field.
And out of the medical field.
But that is, just so everyone knows, there is absolutely no science behind that claim. I want to make that absolutely clear to everybody who's listening.
Yeah.
Great. I'm glad you did, because he claimed that he heard it from some doctor or something like that.
Hey, Tim, thank you very much for the call.
Sure.
Great call. Appreciate it. 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. We're going to get in right now. There are only two people on the line. We'll be able to get you, and we'll be right back.
Support for WAMC comes from Premier Medical Group of the Hudson Valley, gastroenterology and urology specialists with offices in Dutchess, Ulster, and Orange counties. PremierMedicalHV.com. Anderson Center for Autism, Statsburg, New York, celebrating National Autism Awareness this month. AndersonCenterForAutism.org. Paradise Copies, Northampton, Massachusetts, providing printing design for customers for over 20 years. From digital to offset, color copies, scans, logos, and more, ParadiseCopies.com. The 1850 House Inn and Tavern, Rosendale, New York, newly renovated boutique hotel in the heart of the Hudson Valley, 12 guest rooms with modern amenities and located close to the rail trail and outdoor activities. The1850House.com. And Rhinebeck Artist Shops, Rhinebeck and New Paltz, providing professional picture framing, fine art materials, now open the Atwater Art Gallery in Rhinebeck, atwatergallery.com.
We're back with our wonderful friends here at Dr. Amy Novat and Dr. Rachel Mash, we're talking about obstetrics and gynecology, but mostly gynecology today. Because those two ways of doing this work have sort of separated out a little bit. But let's go to Annie in Kingston. Okay, Annie, you're on.
Hello.
Hi, Annie, you're on.
Fine. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Is lichen sclerosis a condition of the skin that would go in and around the vagina?
Yes, it is.
Amy, yeah.
It is.
What is it for the rest of us?
Lichen sclerosis is a disease of the skin, and it is of unknown causes, and it results in white patches on the skin, sometimes some scarring and what we call agglutination, particularly of the external genitalia.
And what do we do about it?
It's a pretty difficult clinical challenge, actually. There are a number of different approaches towards treating it. Many women have found that there are topical treatments that can be quite helpful, some of which include some steroid creams. An old treatment includes the use of testosterone. Sometimes there are actually injections of some local numbing medicine. But often what women find very helpful are changes in diet, certainly uses of external creams and lotions, and lifestyle changes can be quite helpful.
Now, you practice in Kingston, right?
I do.
Okay. So any follow-up on that?
Yes. Would it be helpful not to eat sugar, high carb?
Well, that's a great question, and it's a big one, because I believe sugar intake in excess can be difficult with any medical condition.
Yes.
It increases the risk of infection. It certainly changes the impact of the hormonal environment. So certainly watching your sugar intake is probably important for your entire well-being, but probably affects the lichen sclerosis, probably from the perspective of yeast overgrowth, that when people are eating too much sugar, they're having more yeast within the gut GI tract that then is within the vagina as well.
Rachel, anything to add?
I think one of the things to add is that if you have the lichen sclerosis presents with white plaques, what we call white plaques, which are silvery white patches in that area. And one of the things I would recommend would be to make sure that you get that biopsied, because we want to make sure that that is what it is. We want to make sure that lichen sclerosis, that is what it is going on, and that there's not anything else that that is happening there. So I would say that if you can have it biopsied then and proven to be lichen sclerosis, then you can go on to have the treatments that Dr. Novat has alluded to.
Annie, yeah, I think that's very. Pardon me, Al.
No, pardon me.
I think that's very important, because there are changes to the external genitalia, or specifically the vulva, that can mimic each other. They can look very much alike. So the biopsy is very helpful.
What do you mean they can look alike?
I did go to my gynecologist, and she just gave me a steroid, but she didn't say that what it was. But I have some of those white, silvery, whatever's right on my chest. And I was thinking, well, maybe the itching down there is caused by, maybe that's the same thing I have down there that I have up on the chest. But she didn't recommend a biopsy, so I'm not positive that it is there. I'm just trying to think that when I go back to her, I can say more, give her more information.
Yeah, I think that you've brought up a good issue. There are certainly topical conditions that can affect you from scalp to toe, including the genital region. And so what you might have is something like psoriasis, and I don't know that that's what you have, but something like psoriasis, which can often affect the torso and the elbows and knees, but can also affect the genitalia and can have kind of a pearly white appearance that may be mistaken by a clinician as lichen. So I think that a biopsy would be helpful for you and your clinician in terms of treatment.
Now, can these be transferred via intercourse or not?
No, as far as we know. No.
Okay. Hey, Annie.
I haven't been there in years.
Okay, Annie, thanks so much for the call. Appreciate
it. Thank
you.
Yeah. Bye-bye.
Yeah. Okay, let's go to Mickey in Albany. Mickey, you're on.
Hello there, everybody.
Hi.
Question. How long after a complete hysterectomy for endometrial cancer should follow-ups be done, or do they need to be done? And is there a correlation between that and colon cancer, as I've recently heard?
Okay, before we answer, we need a couple of definitions for us in the audience. One is, what is endometriosis?
I think she said endometrial cancer.
Yes, okay, endometrial cancer. Shows you again how unprepared I am. And also, what the implications, the further implications of all of this are. Rachel?
So endometrial cancer is an overgrowth of the endometrium. The endometrium is the lining of the uterus. That's
right.
Typically where a pregnancy would grow, in the endometrial cavity. And it has cells that can become hyperplastic, or grow too thick. And when those cells grow too thick, there can be become, those cells can become atypical, and then they can lead on to cancer. So a thickened endometrial lining, which can have atypical cells, which can then become endometrial cancer,
okay,
which usually spreads from the endometrium, the inside of the uterus, and can spread then outward. This is typically a hormonally sensitive cancer, an estrogen-sensitive cancer.
So then what do we do about it?
So endometrial cancer, depending on what stage it happens to be in, if it is endometrial cancer, we usually do a hysterectomy.
And a hysterectomy is?
Taking out the uterus, so okay, removing the uterus. And depending on the and how advanced the cancer is, it may require additional lymph node sampling or other removal of other things in the vicinity of the uterus.
And Mickey, your question then is?
How long does follow-up need to be done after that? Pap smears, or what is the usual follow-up afterwards?
Dr. Amy Novak?
The usual recommendation is that you have an exam by a either a gynecological oncologist or certainly a gynecologist every 3 months for 2 years, and then every 6 months for 5 years, and then annually after that. Now, that may be changed or altered depending upon the stage of the cancer, as Rachel spoke about. For people who are identified to have very early endometrial cancer, they may not need that every 3 month type visit or schedule. And currently, and there's a lot of discussion about this, the use of the pap smear as a way of following or screening people for any cancer that may regrow in the vagina or be left in the vagina after treatments, is that most of us are still doing pap smears of the vagina after the surgery. But I want to make clear, because I think that this the terminology of total hysterectomy and different words that are used to describe this surgery, if I can just be clear about what we mean when we talk about that. So for cancer surgeries, what we typically do is a total abdominal hysterectomy, which means removal of the uterus and the cervix, which is the lower segment of the uterus. And fancy words are the bilateral salpingo-oophorectomy, which means the removal of the ovaries and fallopian tubes. Sometimes when people say total hysterectomy, they're meaning all of those organs, but in fact it just refers to the uterus, not to the ovaries and fallopian tubes. And in cancer surgeries, we typically will remove all of those organs.
Dr. Rachel Mash?
Also, I want to just make it clear that uterine cancer or endometrial cancer is, again, an estrogen-sensitive cancer, whereas cervical cancer has a very different etiology. That is caused by, as we spoke about earlier, the human papillomavirus. So there are very different etiologies for those two cancers. And so, yes, many people still do pap smears, but just so you know that the estrogen-sensitive cancer, endometrial cancer, can put someone at increased risk for breast cancer. And I know you had mentioned colon cancer, and there is a syndrome that can involve all of those things. And so you should be speaking to your physician and or oncologist about what screening tests are needed with your particular diagnosis.
So so I just wanted to make an addition to what we said before. In the break, I said, why aren't we giving injections to vaccines to boys as well as girls? And you guys responded.
So we are. There is a recommendation to give the vaccine to boys as well.
Yeah.
So it's okay, both girls and boys, and hopefully before what we call sexual debut, or before they become sexually active.
Yeah, that's. Hey, Mickey, thanks for the call. Appreciate it very
much. Thank you.
Yeah. Let's go to Anne in Saratoga. Anne, you're on.
Hi. Thank you for being here with this show. Basically, I'm asking a twofold question. One is for people that are middle-aged that are going back into sexual activity due to their situation, divorce, et cetera, what do they need to get that HPV vaccination? And the second question is, let's say a person has a total hysterectomy involving everything but a cervix. Will they need to get an HPV vaccination?
So can I just ask you, are you saying that everything's removed but they still have their cervix? Is that what you're saying?
Correct.
Okay. So let me take your first one first. Regardless of sexual activity, so whether or not you haven't been sexually active for years and now just are becoming sexually active again, the recommendations are the same for Pap smear screening if your Pap smears have been negative. If you've had three consecutive negative Pap smears in the last 10 years, if you've never had a high-grade abnormal Pap smear, and if your Pap smear and HPV test are negative and you're over 30 years old, it is still, regardless of sexual activity, you should be getting Pap smears every 5 years if you fit into all of those criteria.
And how do you do a Pap smear again?
You take a spatula you put a speculum inside the vagina, visualize the cervix, and you take some samples from the outside of the ectocervix or the outside of the cervix, and you take a cytobrush, something that looks similar to a mascara brush, actually, and you go into the endocervix or the inside of the cervix.
You put that on a slide? Is that what?
Not anymore. In this country, typically, we could put it on a slide, and we used to for years. We now put it in liquid media. So that is one. But they've been shown to be similar in terms of results.
So, Anne, thank you for the call. Appreciate it very much. Okay.
Didn't answer the second part of it. If you did have a cervix, would you, despite having Pap smears in there, fine, would you still need to get that HPV vaccination to prevent HPV?
So anyone with a cervix needs to be screened. So regardless of whether you have your uterus, if you still have your cervix, you need to be screened. And the HPV vaccine really works best for women who have not been exposed to high-risk HPV strains. So there are some virginal women who are just becoming sexually active in their 30s, 40s, or 50s. And we discuss that. Insurance probably won't cover it, but we do discuss getting them the vaccine because those are women that may benefit from it, although the studies really did not look into that age group. But anybody who has been sexually active in the past probably would not benefit as much from the HPV vaccine later in life.
I probably haven't been listening carefully enough, but how do you know whether the woman has HPV or not?
Through a Pap smear.
Oh, through the Pap smear.
Yes.
Okay. Mm-hmm. All right. Great. Anne, thank you for calling. Appreciate it.
Welcome. Thank you.
Yeah. Let's go to Steve in Massachusetts. Okay, Steve, you're on.
Hi. I wanted to switch things up a little bit here and ask the doctors. Well, my wife and I are having our first child in a couple months, and my wife has been tapering for a number of years, is now on a very low dose of Sebutex, about 2 milligrams a day. And we've been getting conflicting information. Our OB has said it's fine to breastfeed, and some of the literature, including some of the literature we got from the hospital, has said that we should not. So just wanted to get your take on that if you had any other concerns.
Dr. Novad, you want to go first?
Yeah, hi, Steve. Congratulations to you and your wife.
Thank you. Very exciting.
And I apologize. I didn't hear what she's taking.
I didn't hear what she's got. In other words, what the disease is.
It's Sebutex or Suboxone equivalent.
And why is she taking that?
She's recovering from addiction.
Oh.
Okay.
Have we stumped the docs?
As I said, I wanted to switch it up a bit, but I thought that you may have good answers for this. Maybe not.
So I think, specifically that medication, to be perfectly honest, I would have to look that up and to see where, there's something, what we call teratogenicity, whether or not it causes any problems to a growing fetus. However, many medications, there are very few medications that women who are pregnant really can't take. There are some, for sure.
Well, we've already been advised on that. I was looking, I guess, and our baby's been fine through all the stress tests and everything, but wondering more, I guess, on the breastfeeding angle after, an infancy.
So typically, if taking it while she's pregnant is okay. Taking it while she's breastfeeding should also be fine because those two typically go in concert with each other. And there is some dilution that happens through the breast milk. So it probably, there will be some in the breast milk. But if she has been able to take this small dose while she's pregnant, typically that should be fine for when she's breastfeeding as well.
Now, if you look up, doctors, and we have to take a break, but if you look up this medication on the web, are you likely to see what the contraindications are for it?
There's actually
yes.
a really good resource that is specific to medications during pregnancy and lactation that can be specifically seen, that you can look up and look specifically what the recommendations are for both pregnancy and lactation.
Do you remember the name of the web page? No, but you can.
If you just type in pregnancy, lactation, or postpartum and lactation, and I just a kind of a just a practical point as well.
Sure.
We often will think about medications and their safety profile in pregnancy and postpartum with lactation and ask the question, are the risks greater than the benefits or the benefits greater than the risks? And if this medication has assisted your wife in avoiding drugs that might otherwise be known dangers to the fetus or your newborn and to your wife, then this medicine may prove to be the best intervention.
Thank you so much. Steve, thanks for calling. Okay, we're going to take a very short break, maybe 7 seconds. We'll be right back.
Support for WAMC comes from St. Francis Hospital and Health Centers, Poughkeepsie, serving the healthcare needs of the community, including trauma and emergency care and the Center for Robotic Surgery, sfhospital.org. Marriott Town Place Suites, Albany Downtown, offering studio 1 and 2 bedroom suites with fully equipped kitchens. Amenities include indoor pool, breakfast, local transportation, Wi-Fi, and parking. 518-860-1500 for reservations. Sunflower Natural Foods Market, Woodstock, New York, presenting their annual Earth Day Festival, food samples, raffles, local health practitioners, and green organizations. Saturday, April 20th, noon till 3, sunflowernatural.com. And Mount St. Mary College, Newburgh, presenting Junior Jumpstart, a visit and tour day for high school juniors on April 27th, msmc.edu.
We are back, thank goodness. With us is the great producer of this program, Patrick Donges. Patrick, we have a question via
yes,
the social media.
We do, Alan. This is from email. It's an anonymous question. There are two short questions, so I'm just going to throw them both out there, docs. I am 44 years old and have never been pregnant and do not plan to have children. Is there any way to find out if I was ever able to conceive, is number one. Two is, what are your opinions on the procedure that removes the lining of the uterus to stop menstruation?
Shall I answer it?
Sure.
Okay, so that would be Amy Novak. Amy?
There is no test. There are no tests that would help us understand whether you were capable of getting pregnant in the past.
Okay.
As we say in the office, well, you only know if you can't get pregnant if you try. There are tests out there that look at certain hormones in the body that there are signs to suggest they may tell us about the health of the egg and therefore your capacity to get pregnant, but even the best infertility people will discuss the challenges of that science.
Okay.
Dr. Rachel?
Agreed with all of that, and really it's trying. People who, even some of our tests where people say, oh, your follicle stimulating hormone is much too high, you're not going to get pregnant, and then they're pregnant the next month. There are fluctuating levels of this hormone. So we can have an idea as to where you may be in your reproductive life. There was a recent article, actually, about your final menstrual period and trying to predict when your final menstrual period would be, utilizing a series of different blood tests. But that's still experimental, and we don't have the answers to that. But that doesn't quite address the question of reproductive capacity.
Right.
So.
Anything
then,
else, Patrick?
Well, the other question was opinions on the procedure that removes the lining of the uterus to stop menstruation.
That is called an endometrial ablation, and there are several techniques in which to do that ablation technique, and it can be very efficacious for people. The concerns are it's not 100%, meaning that there are some women who will have the procedure and find that in spite of it, they will still have periods. Those periods are sometimes heavy, or that it might work for a couple of years and then not work after that. But about 80 to 83% of women who have it are very satisfied with the results of the procedure. And again, there are several different types of approaches towards doing it, so I would recommend that you speak to your clinician about which approach he or she might use and why they choose that. And there's a lot of information online about these endometrial ablation procedures.
Great.
Thank you very much, Patrick.
Thank you, Ellen.
See you soon. Let's go to Jesse in Troy. Okay, Jesse in Troy, you're on.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My wife had babies, twins, actually, 5 months ago, and we were wondering about breastfeeding as a method of contraception. Seems like the conventional wisdom is that you don't really have to use birth control if you're exclusively breastfeeding, which we are, but then when we actually talk to our obstetrician and our, you know, everyone, they seem to think that that wasn't foolproof enough. And I was wondering, you know, whether there is validity to that, and if it's not 100%, kind of what the odds are.
Dr. Rachel Mash.
Well, congratulations about your twins.
Thank you.
That's great. And I'm so glad you brought this up, because what you're talking about is what we call LAM, or lactational amenorrhea method. And to have LAM, or this lactational amenorrhea method, be successful, there are a few criteria that need to be met. One is that you need to be exclusively breastfeeding, and you need to be breastfeeding, that means at least every 3 to 4 hours, a minimum of 5 times per day. And that would, doing that would enable your body, the hypothalamic pituitary axis, that's how all of the hormones interact in your body, that would allow that to be shut down enough to prevent an ovulation. So at least every 3 to 4 hours. The second criteria is that your wife would need to not have her period. She would actually need to be what we call amenorrheic, or not bleeding, not having a period.
Uh-huh.
And the third would be that you need to be, the baby or babies need to be less than 6 months of age. Because once 6 months happened, usually cereal or some kind of solids are introduced, some sort of food is introduced, and so the breastfeeding decreases. So if the babies are less than 6 months, you're exclusively breastfeeding every 3 to 4 hours, and she is not bleeding, it is a, not foolproof, but a very good method of birth control. If any of those things are not met, then you need to be using an alternative method.
Okay, so the twins now are sleeping through the night. So she is breastfeeding probably 5 to 6 times a day, but they go to bed at 6:30 and get up at about 5 in the morning. So there's quite a stretch there where they're not breastfeeding.
So she should make a beeline to her gynecologist and get a different method of contraception.
Okay, great. Well, that's good to know.
Well, yep.
Thank you, Jesse. Appreciate it. Yeah.
Thank you. Yep.
1-800-348-2551, one free phone. Roberta from Schenectady. Okay, Roberta, how you doing?
Doing well, Alan, doing well. Look forward to seeing you in June with one-third of the fund drive gone by.
Indeed.
If everyone will put some money in the lockbox.
Bless you, my dear, bless you.
I'm calling for women of reproductive age who do not have an OB-GYN and don't know where to go for their yearly gynecological exam. I would recommend their local Planned Parenthood. They will take you without insurance. If you are of very low income, they will connect you with insurance. Planned Parenthoods also have the ability to screen for the abnormal cells and do cryotherapy and LEAP. So a plug for affordable health care.
Okay, so who's going to react, or do we need to react?
Well, I'm going to react,
okay,
because I've known Rachel a long time, so I feel very confident I will be speaking for her, that we are both strong advocates of Planned Parenthood, and they provide a wonderful service throughout the country to particularly women who are, do not have access to private OBGYNs. The other opportunity for people with limited access are hospital settings that may have clinics taking care of a population of women who are unable to otherwise find care.
What does that word mean, clinic?
It is usually a setting where women, men, whatever kind of clinic it is, can get medical care either free or a sliding scale, or where the hospital or the government is subsidizing the care.
So what you have to do, find out when the hospital is having a clinic, is that right?
Well, I'm sure it varies across the country, right. But most clinics and hospitals are open, you know, every day. They may not have a gynecological clinic every day. It might alternate with a cardiology clinic or a urological clinic.
Yeah.
But big hospital settings will usually have such opportunities also for women.
Well, Roberta, we love you. Thanks for calling.
You're very welcome. Also, let me just...
Sure.
Put one more plug in
sure.
here. With Planned Parenthood, the OBGYN clinic is every day.
Ah,
thank you very much, guys.
Thanks.
Good program.
Bye. Bye. Let's go to Gary in Colony. Gary in Colony, you're on.
Yes, hi. I don't want to be a downer here, but I want to give the other side of the HPV vaccine. Now, I wonder if either one of the doctors have read Vaccine Epidemic.
I have read excerpts of it, yes.
Yeah, it's pretty scary, and I'm a big Gary Noel guy, and he's done show after show with Dr. Cheryl Tenpenny, if you're familiar with her. She basically is someone who was a baby doctor, and everything was going wrong. Basically, the kids were getting sick with the vaccines and everything, so she went on a 10-year study period, 4 hours a day, 365 days a year to study vaccines. And she was horrified. And this HPV vaccine has killed, attributed to deaths of probably 100 girls. It's definitely in the 80s, and some are saying now it's over 100. And if you looked at that book and you saw a perfectly healthy girl, 13 years old after that shot, like within a week, it's pretty scary.
Okay, that's your question.
I just want to know if you're aware of it and let other people, before they go getting these things, because they're really...
Well, no, sick. Gary, you've made the point. Now we're going to ask the question. Go ahead.
Sure, go ahead. Thanks.
Dr. Amy Novak.
Gary, thank you for your comment. And I think it's very important to honor the varied perspectives out there around vaccines. And
yep.
There is... you know, we give the most vaccines of any country in the world, and in a very short period of time.
Yep.
And it begs the question of whether what we're doing is appropriate, safe, and efficacious. And just of interest, Rachel and I were having a conversation en route to the studio today just about this very issue. And, you know, what we know and what we don't know, and this is the challenge of all scientific exploration. It's an attempt to do good and no harm. And I share with you some of the concerns about vaccines, and I continue to read from both perspectives. And but remember that vaccines aren't just for Americans. They're for people all over the world. And in some environments, vaccines are truly life-saving and change the face in which the people can live. So I know that Rachel does a lot of work overseas, and I've worked with her doing that work. And the vaccine, Gardasil, has the potential of having a huge impact on preventing cervical cancer, which is the number two killer of women, you know, throughout the world.
So we're not talking 80 people here. We're talking, you know, thousands, maybe millions.
Millions.
Yeah.
That's up to debate, though. I mean, really. I mean,
it isn't.
And when they say that the vaccine works, they haven't proven it. They haven't proven it. And if you're doing pap smears, you're going to catch it anyhow.
Well, one of the issues...
And your human body will actually get rid of it.
Hey, Gary. Rachel's going
So
there.
Just one of the issues, Gary, thanks. Yeah, Dr. Novak is right. I'm glad that you brought this up. But one of the issues is pap smears in low-resource settings are almost impossible to implement. So we have primary prevention, which would be with vaccination, and secondary prevention, which would be with screening. But people who live in really low-resource settings really don't have access to pap smears, and that is not something that... they can do. So if we could have some primary prevention, that would be the best.
Now, we also know, for example, that polio doesn't exist in this country anymore, but there are a few sites in the world where it does exist.
And that site is normally from a vaccine that was introduced.
Well, that sounds nutty to me.
Well, it probably does, but it's true.
Yeah.
And I can give
you...
How
do you know it's true?
Well, because if you look at the statistics, and I've also listened to a bunch of people and read all kinds of stuff.
Yeah.
And there are doctors that have just studied this, just polio.
Okay,
hold on. And found out what they changed the name of it.
Oh, brother.
It's like the whole thing just gets real convoluted.
Oh, okay, Dr. Mash.
Just one last thing. Centers for Disease Control, because this was an issue that came up, there was real concern being raised about the HPV vaccine. And so the CDC looked at the registries that they had of all the girls who did receive the vaccine. And the CDC did come up, after looking at all of the girls, that there were deaths, but the deaths were no more than the deaths in people who had not received the vaccine. So the number of deaths that occurred in girls who did receive the vaccine was not increased from those who did not. So there was no increase from baseline. So if you want to just take a look at the CDC, what the CDC found about the HPV vaccine, that might be interesting as well.
Yeah, you ought to Gary. I want to get it. It was only a couple more minutes, and you know, you sort of had your time, and we'll leave it at that. Thank you very much.
Thanks for sure.
Thanks to let's go to Jim in Albany. Jim, you got to hurry up. Go ahead.
Hey, Alan, good show, and thank you, doctors. In your opening comments, you said that the guidelines for pap smears have changed. Give us a little history of science in a nutshell. When did they change? When did they start doing pap smears? When did they change?
Jim, I'm so sorry, but we'll give you a one sentence each. But I tell you, we're really out of time, so go ahead.
How much harm were they doing? Is that why the pap smears were changed? They must have been doing some harm, right?
No, actually, pap smears decrease cervical cancer mortality in this country by up to 70%. But as we have been able to understand more about the pathophysiology of cervical cancer secondary to HPV, the human papillomavirus, we realize actually that there is a long, long precancerous stage that it doesn't typically go from normal to being invasive cancer, and therefore we can increase the screening, the time for screening, and still be able to decrease mortality.
And that's Dr. Rachel Mash.
Was there any harm being done by the pap smears?
No, there's no harm. It's not an invasive test.
Why did they change? Why did they change the guidelines?
You got a lay guy over here. Because they found out they didn't need all of that, right? Is that right, Amy? They found out they didn't need all of it. So,
yeah. Yes. Thankfully, the science is working in conjunction with being fiscally responsible, and the science has showed us very, very clearly that the etiology of cervical cancer is HPV, and that if HPV can be screened for, and understanding again what Dr. Mash spoke about, this long precancerous state, that we can spread these pap smears out. Now, it's true, this is a philosophical or cultural challenge for women, because when we were in training, you saw a doctor every year. So seeing people every 3 years or having pap smears every 3 to 5 years is very difficult. But just to clarify, this doesn't mean women should only see their doctors every 3 years. It's about going to the doctor every year, but maybe not having the actual pap smear at that time.
Okay. Hey,
thank you very much.
Thank you so much. Okay, and I'm so sorry. I want to apologize to Carrie of Greenfield, Massachusetts, who wanted to know about tests to determine reproductive health for adoptive people. Do we have something we can say in a minute or less than a minute? No, we'd have to know more. Okay, we appreciate it. And Carrie, was so sorry that we can't get to you, but we are out of time, and I appreciate your calling. All right. So now, Dr. Amy Novat and Dr. Rachel Mash, thank you so much for being with us. You guys are obviously at the top of your field, and we are so grateful to you for being here. It's wonderful to see you.
Thank you so much for having us.
Okay. It's been a pleasure.
And support for Medical Monday comes from the hospitals of HealthQuest and HealthQuest Medical Practice, physicians offering primary and specialty health care in private office settings throughout the Hudson Valley. 1-888-525-4767 for appointments. comments. Thanks again for joining us on the Vox Pop. And remember, you can go to WAMC.org and you can just listen to this whole program again if you want to. Our engineer has been Zach Malloy. Thanks to Arab Krupke for answering the phones. Our producer is Patrick Donges. You've heard from him today. I'm Alan Shartok. Tomorrow on Vox Pop, we'll talk immigration with some special guests. Stay tuned now for a news update. Again, thank you all for being with us.